Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, July 15th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Proposition A passes. Hospital proposition passes easily. Midland County voters overwhelmingly approve sales tax addition by Stuart Doreen. Midland County residents didn't have any problem approving a sales tax increase to help the Midland County Hospital District. More than 70% of those voting in the election favored passage of a quarter cent sales tax addition inside the city and county to be used by the hospital district to help offset anticipated federal revenue loss. Of the 10,169 votes, 7,135 called for its passage. That was 70.16% of the vote. The lopsided victory for Proposition A marked the second time in 11 years Midland's Rosalind Grover led a successful hospital tax election campaign. People care about health care, Grover said Tuesday. I have lived here all my life. I believe in Midland and believe in the voters. Tell them what the story is, and they will vote for it if it is good. They looked at Proposition A and said, we need health care. The sales tax increase will go into effect before the end of the year. The amount of the sales tax on the ballot is 0.25%. That amounts to a quarter for every $100 spent on eligible goods. Currently, the sales tax inside the city of Midland is 8%. The sales tax inside the city now is capped at 8.25%. The quarter cent of sales tax could potentially raise as much as $30 million for the hospital district to use for community health services funding, including the nonprofits, Midland Community Healthcare Services, contracted physicians, mental health services, ER calls, and Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said previously that reductions in Medicaid supplement reimbursements are projected to reach $23 million in fiscal year 2021 and $38.4 million by fiscal year 2024. Hospital district officials also have said that more than $40.147 million was spent in community health care services in fiscal year 2019. Benefits of those services include compensation paid to more than 200 physicians, more than 75% of active medical staff. Midlanders appeared to rally around the ballot item from the time the campaign started. Support included op-eds sent to the Reporter Telegram from OGX Resources' Richard Coates, Drs. Shelton and Reagan Viney, Nadine Craddock, Museum of the Southwest Director Daniel Eck, and Crown Quest Operating's Tim Dunn. Conservative oil men Ernest Angelo and Don Sparks also provided letters to the editor in support of Proposition A. Grover was the architect of a $115 million hospital bond that passed by nearly 25% of the vote in 2019. It was the first $100 million bond passed inside Midland County. This article is entitled, Myers, Midland Memorial Hospital has record number of coronavirus patients, by Caitlin Randall. As in most Texas hospitals, the number of coronavirus patients receiving treatment at Midland Memorial Hospital is at a record high, creating a significant strain on resources and staff. CEO Russell Myers said Tuesday there are 46 COVID-19 patients at Midland Memorial, the highest number since the pandemic reached Midland 4 months ago. Of those patients, 32 are in the regular COVID-19 unit and 14 are in the critical care unit. 8 critical care patients are on ventilators, he said. The 4th of July weekend likely contributed to the rise in cases, although hospitalizations have been steadily increasing since Memorial Day, Myers said during a press conference. This is 10 days after July 4th, here on the 14th, so we should be in the thick of whatever that weekend may have produced here. Today and over the next couple of days, he said. But we were already well into this growth process before the 4th of July weekend. The hospital recently entered its surge plan in response to the rising case numbers, shuffling coronavirus patients to a larger floor and adding more beds. With the added capacity, there is room for 42 patients in the regular COVID-19 unit and 18 in the critical care unit. Chief Nursing Officer Kit Breedemus said, "There are also plans that would allow about 14 additional beds between the two units," he said. However, Myers cautioned that while beds may be available, staffing that many beds remains an issue. "It's not physical space that is the challenge. It's not even the ventilator availability. It's staff," he said. "While we may be able to add more physical beds and make them available, having enough of the right, well-trained people to care for patients in those environments is the day-to-day challenge." MMH's Human Resources Department is continually seeking traveling nurses to assist with treating coronavirus patients, Myers said. Additionally, he said they are open to hiring respiratory therapists or nurses in the community who are out of work or who have recently retired. "Although most people who contract the coronavirus will be asymptomatic, the 10 to 20% who develop severe symptoms require constant monitoring," Chief Medical Officer Dr. Larry Wilson said. "Those who need hospitalization may experience a range of symptoms, from hallmarks such as cough and lung inflammation to lesser known symptoms, including dehydration, decreased liver or kidney function, and behavioral changes," he said. "And while most respiratory illnesses last between a week and 10 days, COVID-19 can leave patients feeling sick for much longer," Wilson said. "This doesn't play that way," he said. "It can be 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or longer with this post-inflammatory process where they just stay ill, even when it appears that the infection has gone away." This article reads, 142nd District Court Judge Rogers lands victory in race, by Stuart Doreen. Republicans selected David Rogers to be the person to replace Jody Gillis as the presiding judge in the 142nd District Court. The criminal defense attorney captured 61.1% of the vote in the Republican Party runoff against Mary Baker on Tuesday night to earn the party's nomination. Because there is no Democratic Party nominee, Rogers will replace Gillis, who announced he will retire when his term ends in December. "I am humbled by support from the voters," said Rogers, a graduate of Texas A&M University. "I congratulate Mary. She ran a tough campaign." Rogers collected 62% of the vote after early voting ballots in person and mail-in were counted. Rogers had been the top vote-getter during the three-person primary in March, with 48.37% of the 19,421 votes. Rogers said Tuesday night that he felt his trial experience and being board certified in criminal law helped him connect with the voters during the primary and in the runoff. "Being a judge is something you always think about," Rogers said. "Then the opportunity presented itself. In Midland, judges don't retire often." Baker, an oil and gas attorney, offered the following message for Rogers. "I'm thrilled for him, especially for winning in what is undeniably an unusual and difficult election year, and hope to watch him continue Midland's tradition of judicial excellence." This article is entitled, "High in Tall City Reaches 111 Degrees. Low of 85 was the highest low temperature in city's history," by Stuart Doreen. Tuesday was one of the hottest days in Midland history. The National Weather Service reported that the high temperature reached 111 degrees, which tied July 14, 2020, with five other days as the sixth hottest day in the city's history. The last time 111 degrees was reached was June 17, 2017. The high temperature, also a record for July 14th, was 16 degrees above normal for this time of year, 95 degrees. The National Weather Service also reported there wasn't relief on Monday night/Tuesday morning, as the low was 85, which was 15 degrees above normal. July 14th will go down in the record books for the highest low temperature ever recorded at Midland International Airport. The previous record was 83. A second straight daily record was not the only consecutive mark during the recent heat wave. The National Weather Service reported Tuesday was the sixth straight day of temperatures at or above 105 degrees. That is tied for the second longest streak in the city's history. The National Weather Service is calling for a high temperature today of 106 degrees. It is not until Saturday that the National Weather Service expects the high temperature to fall below 100. That day, the high is expected to be 99. If the streak continues through Friday, that would be 10 straight days of temperatures 100 degrees or more. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled, Midland New Cases Climbs to 72. City also reports 22nd COVID-19 death by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Health Department reported 72 new confirmed cases of coronavirus Tuesday, bringing the total during the pandemic to 1,255. The 72 cases were the most reported from a day that didn't include a roundup from the weekend. The health department reported 801 people isolating at home. It also showed the number of Midland County residents said to have recovered jumped from 393 to 443. There are 801 active cases inside Midland County. The health department also reported the second 22nd COVID-19 death involving a Midland County resident. The woman in her 80s who was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital died Tuesday, according to the city. The age group with the most confirmed cases Tuesday was 40 to 49 with 17. The health department also reported 20 to 29 was second with 15 and 30 to 39 was third with 14. This article is entitled MCH Reports 18th, 19th Coronavirus Deaths by J.C. Lewis. The Medical Center Health System reported its 18th and 19th coronavirus-related deaths on Tuesday, according to a press release. The 18th patient was a 61-year-old woman who died at midnight. The patient was transferred from Reeves County on July 8th. The 19th patient was a 60-year-old man who died late Tuesday morning. The patient was a resident at Siena Nursing and Rehabilitation and was admitted to MCH on Saturday. Both patients had pre-existing conditions, according to the releases. MCH is treating 51 coronavirus patients. The critical care unit has 8 patients with 5 on ventilators. The critical care overflow in the Wheatley Stewart Medical Pavilion has 5 patients, all on ventilators. The remaining 38 patients are on the coronavirus isolation floors. 11 patients are from Siena Nursing and Rehabilitation, 2 are from Focused Care in Odessa, 2 are from Clover House, 4 are from Andrews County, and 2 are from Pecos County. The hospital has tested a total of 4,156, with 725 positive results, 3,026 negative results, and 405 pending tests. This article is entitled, More Than 10,000 Remain in Texas Hospitals, from the Associated Press. Austin, Texas continued to report more than 10,000 patients hospitalized with the coronavirus Monday, as the state tries containing the spread in what has become one of America's biggest hot zones. As Republican Governor Greg Abbott warns that the worst is yet to come in Texas, state health officials reported more than 40 new deaths and 5,600 new cases following what had been the deadliest week of the pandemic in the state. There is typically a decline in numbers following a weekend when reporting from counties is slower. The true number of cases is likely far higher because many people have not been tested, and studies suggest people can be infected and not feel sick. County leaders in the hard-hit Rio Grande Valley on Monday asked Abbott to give them broader emergency powers as hospitals exceed capacity. Top officials in Houston have also called for stay-at-home orders, while Abbott has said putting Texas back on lockdown is a last resort. For most people, the new coronavirus causes mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever and cough, that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia and death. This article is entitled, Breedemus, We're Fighting a Battle on Two Fronts at Midland Memorial. Hospital staff being bombarded with negative comments, criticism, Chief Nursing Officer says, by Caitlin Randall. Hospital workers are feeling defeated after being bombarded by negative comments and criticism, Midland Memorial's Chief Nursing Officer said Tuesday. He asked members of the community to show support by sending those on the front lines a message of kindness. Below is Chief Nursing Officer Kit Breedemus's statement in full. We have a fantastic team of doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, and many other professionals that are working nonstop every day to make sure that we can protect our community from the effects of COVID-19. We've all dedicated our lives to serving others in their time of need. But what we are is human, and we are starting to fatigue. We are getting tired. Our frontline staff workers are continuing to see this day in and day out. And as we see a rise in volumes, it becomes even more challenging. Our heroes are delivering patient care, and we need your support now more than ever to continue this fight against a common enemy. Prioritizing mental health and managing stress is critical during these challenging times, and healthcare workers are not immune. I cannot underestimate the physical and emotional toll that this work takes on us. When this pandemic began, there was an amazing outpouring of support and love for our teams, and our social media was filled up with encouragement and praise, and it gave us all the strength to keep going. Where there once was that inspiration and optimism, we are now finding ourselves dealing with mistrust, malice, and anger. And it feels like we're fighting a battle on two fronts. My staff and I are increasingly bombarded with negative comments and criticism that fill up our social media, our emails, and our texts. And it's starting to wear. I cannot begin to explain the feelings of defeat and frustration that come from when you've poured yourself fully into the care of a dying or ill patient just to be met with criticism and anger. I want everyone listening to know that we have the entire community's best interests at heart. You are all our family and friends, and believe me when I say we are trying our best. I encourage everyone to please take the time to acknowledge our frontline caregivers and everyone who works in the hospital to provide care for our patients. I know the road ahead of us is long and it is uncertain. But as the banner behind me states, we are stronger together. Thank you for those of you out there who are continuing to support us. Simple gestures of appreciation are critical. So I'm asking you to please take the time today to drop a message of kindness to a healthcare worker. This can be in the form of a thank you, a post, text, anything. We will get through this together if we show kindness and patience for one another. To my frontline caregivers out there, everyone who's in the trenches, thank you for your dedication and your resilience. Understand that what you do matters more than you will ever know.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, July 15, 2020. Treat collaboration. Customers enjoy a gelato and donut Saturday as Sister Doe collaborates with Amara Gelato at 3303 North Midkiff Road. Gas prices. Midland-Odessa gas prices have risen 8.5 cents per gallon in the past week, averaging $2.04 a gallon on Monday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 156 retailers. Gas prices in Midland-Odessa are 18.5 cents per gallon higher than a month ago and stand 54.8 cents per gallon lower than a year ago. The following are historical gasoline prices for June 13 in Midland-Odessa going back 10 years. 2019, $2.59 a gallon. 2018, $3.07 a gallon. 2017, $2.10 a gallon. 2016, $2.12 a gallon. 2015, $2.54 a gallon. 2014, $3.53 a gallon. 2013, $3.49 a gallon. 2012, $3.32 a gallon. 2011, $3.59 a gallon. 2010, $2.67 a gallon. Source, GasBuddy.com. Washington Pool is open today. The city's pools, Doug Russell and Washington Family Aquatic Center, are open on alternating days during coronavirus pandemic. Washington is open today for 2 3-hour sessions, noon to 3 p.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. Passes are $3 and go on sale at the pool 30 minutes before opening. Passes are good only for the day of purchase. Museum to host private visits. The Museum of the Southwest is offering private household visits, according to a Facebook post. The museum is opening the Wagner Wing for families to view current exhibitions Lonesome Dove, Buscemi Studios, Unlocking Potential, and Large Escapes Selections from the permanent collection for private visits. Families can reserve a one-hour block for their household, up to 8 people, to view galleries in an exclusive and socially distanced setting. Only one household is permitted per time slot. Masks are required, and the museum will be cleaned between each visit, according to the post. The visits are free for museum members and Midland County Public Library cardholders and $15 per household for non-members. Tuesday through July 24 is reserved for museum members only. To reserve tickets, visit museumsw.org. Bubba's fundraiser to benefit veterans. Bubba's 33 restaurant on Loop 250 near Midland Park Mall will be participating in a fundraiser for Homes for Our Troops. For every Patriot burger sold August 5 through 31, the chain will donate $1 to the nonprofit that builds custom homes for post-9/11 veterans who are injured in the line of duty, according to a press release from Bubba's. Also during this time, customers may register to win a free burger every week for a year. Homes for Our Troops has completed more than 295 homes in 42 states and has 79 projects underway. Caregiver Conference moves online. The 16th annual Caregiver Conference will be presented 9 a.m. to noon, August 7, via Zoom. The free event is sponsored by Area Agency on Aging and Permian Basin Regional Planning Commission. The speaker is Tipa Snow, founder of Positive Approach to Care, PAC, a company that provides dementia care training, services, and products. Deadline to register is July 31. To register, contact Susan Fredrickson at sfredrickson@aaapb.com or 262-4962 and leave a voicemail. For more information about the speaker, visit teepasnow.com. Cowboy Way Jubilee canceled. San Angelo. Cowboy Way Jubilee, planned for July 23 through 26 in San Angelo, has been canceled. The event that features Western stars, entertainers, and authors is produced by Leslie Fisher, who moved from Oklahoma to San Angelo to bring the Jubilee to West Texas, according to a press release. The 2021 event is planned for April 29 through May 2 at Fort Concho. Tickets purchased for 2020 can be exchanged for the 2021 event. For more information, go to cowboywayjubilee.com. Today in history. Today is Wednesday, July 15, the 197th day of 2020. There are 169 days left in the year. On this date, in 1975, three American astronauts blasted off aboard an Apollo spaceship hours after two Soviet cosmonauts were launched aboard a Soyuz spacecraft for a mission that included a link-up of the two ships in orbit. In 1996, MSNBC, a 24-hour all-news network, made its debut on cable and internet.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled Republican Party Belongs to Roger Stone by Jonah Goldberg, Tribune News Service. Roger Stone is an infamously execrable force in American politics. Perhaps his only saving grace is that he's not a hypocrite about it. Stone is a proud, quote, dirty trickster, unquote. The GOP kept him on a leash lest his amorality be too closely associated with the Republican brand. Part of his code is that the best defense against legitimate criticism is to shoot the messenger. Admit nothing, deny everything, and launch counterattack. As a proud cynic, if not an outright sybaritic nihilist, Stone would probably find the very notion of legitimate criticism foolish. Nothing is on the level, he said. What's right is whatever you can get away with. It's better to be infamous than never famous at all. These bits of wisdom are laid out in Stone's Rules, which reads like Mao's little red book on Trumpism. I suspect that one reason Stone has a cult following on the right, and among many in the media, a fan club that long predates his status as a Donald Trump loyalist, is his willingness to own his political amorality in an unapologetic soundbite form, thus immunizing himself from conventional charges of hypocrisy. When you turn deceit and dishonor into guiding principles, the only way you can be a hypocrite is if you fail to go low enough. But Stone's hypocrisy exemption isn't transferable. His defenders, and defenders of President Trump's Friday night commutation of Stone's prison sentence for 7 felony counts of perjury, obstruction of Congress, and witness tampering, won't escape judgment for their two-faced behavior. The 3 main commutation defenses, all offered with Stonian shamelessness, are 1. The president has the power to do it. 2. It was warranted because Stone's conviction was part of the Russian hoax. And 3. Other presidents used their pardon and commutation power corruptly too. The first defense is true as far as it goes, though it's a straw man given few dispute it. It also leaves out James Madison's famous example of a non-criminal but impeachable act. If the president be connected in any suspicious manner with any person he shelters from justice, Congress would be within its rights to impeach him for it. Second, whatever you think of the Russia investigation, Stone is guilty of the crimes he was tried for. Indeed, those crimes should enrage those who tout the president's total exoneration. If Stone believed Trump to be wholly innocent and that the Russia collusion claim was a hoax, why not fully cooperate with investigators to clear the air? Moreover, why would Attorney General William Barr, vilified by the left and lionized by the right for being a Trump loyalist, oppose Stone's commutation and defend his prosecution as righteous? The third and most popular defense is the one that reeks of hypocrisy. A common talking point is that Bill Clinton abused his pardon power, too. Of course, Trump's defenders don't say too, because that would concede that Trump is abusing his power. Clinton pardoned his own brother. He pardoned billionaire fugitive and Clinton fundraiser Mark Rich. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled New York State Isn't to be Emulated on How It Handled Coronavirus, by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. If only the rest of the country could handle COVID-19 as well as New York. That's the lament of progressive commentators as coronavirus caused a spike in the Sun Belt and the South. Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin hailed New York City the other day after it reported no deaths for the first time during the pandemic. This is what competent government can accomplish, she gushed. Valerie Jarrett, former aide to Barack Obama, tweeted, "Short-term sacrifice saves lives." Neera Tanden, the head of the progressive think tank, the Center for American Progress, contrasted the response in Democratic states to that in Republican states. "It turns out that we were lucky that this virus hit in blue states first. They had the thinking to take action to stop the spread of the virus in their states." This is all perverse, given that New York is only now emerging from one of the worst COVID-19 debacles on the planet. There is nonetheless a widespread feeling that New York has been blessed with its exemplary leadership. Governor Andrew Cuomo, incredibly enough, has sky-high approval ratings. If New York is going to be held up as the model, Every office holder in the country has a new roadmap for handling the virus. See a significant percentage of residents of your largest city get infected. Barely prevent your hospital system from getting overloaded. Implement a policy that increases infections and deaths at nursing homes. Suffer more than 30,000 deaths and a higher per capita death rate than any country in the world. And then, after all that, get hailed as a hero. If it worked for Cuomo, why not every other governor in the land? In fairness, New York had many factors working against it. It was hit first, while the virus and how to treat it were still poorly understood. And New York City is an international travel hub with densely packed neighborhoods and a heavily packed public transit system. Of course it got hammered. The outbreaks in other parts of the country aren't anything like what happened in New York, at least not yet. What states like Florida, Arizona, Texas, and California are trying to do is avoid New York's fate, even as they are lectured about the superiority of the Empire State's approach. The positivity rate, the percentage of tests coming back positive, has increased in all of these places, and in Arizona has gone above 20%. During the worst of the outbreak in New York, the 7-day moving average for the positivity rate reached an astronomical 50%. Deaths are going up in all these states, but the scale so far is completely different from what New York went through. In New York, about 32,500 people have died. In Florida, a state of comparable population, about 4,300 people have died. In Texas and California, both bigger states, about 3,300 and 7,000 people have died. In per capita terms, New York has had 1,668 deaths per million. In contrast, Arizona has had 308, Florida 199, California 179, and Texas 114. Just in terms of sheer numbers, New York should be a watchword, not something to emulate. It is in a better situation now, but only after the virus burned through much of the city. A state survey found that more than 20% of New York City residents have antibodies to the virus. At clinics in some hard-hit neighborhoods, about 60% of people have tested positive for antibodies. This isn't an experience anyone should want to duplicate. The fact is that the virus isn't interested in scoring partisan points or establishing the superiority of red state versus blue state governance. It is highly infectious and now is hitting places it missed earlier in the pandemic as they have started to reopen. We should wish them the very best and fervently hope they don't suffer the same calamity that befell New York. This column is entitled "Declining Violent Crime is a Win" by Charles Lane, Washington Post. The U.S. median age is 38, which means that probably less than half the population has a clear memory of life in 1991, when the violent crime rate reached its post-1970 peak of nearly 750 per 100,000 people. The rate is roughly half that today. House Majority Whip James Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina, though, is nearly 80. So he had an answer ready when the New York editor David Remnick suggested to him in a recent radio interview that presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden's support for a punitive 1994 crime bill might count against the former vice president as he seeks votes amid a national movement for criminal justice reform. Clyburn told Remnick that black folks almost ran me out of the room when he opposed mandatory minimum sentences while campaigning for Congress in a majority African-American South Carolina district in 1992. At the time, 83% of Americans felt the system was not tough enough on crime, according to the Gallup poll. Nearly half feared walking in their neighborhoods at night. 2 years later, Clyburn told Remnick, he and others in the Congressional Black Caucus voted for Biden's bill. The first lesson from Clyburn's anecdote is an optimistic one about why the country has reached a point where, in contrast to 1992, significant criminal justice reform seems not only politically feasible, but likely. Since 1994, Americans have grown less hawkish on law enforcement. Support for tough measures such as the death penalty or mandatory minimums has fallen to levels not seen in almost 50 years, according to an innovative index of punitive sentiment first published in 2013 by political scientist Mark D. Ramirez of Arizona State University. For several years, in fact, U.S. public opinion has been receptive to new approaches based on less policing and incarceration and more on social services and rehabilitation. In 2016, only 45% of Americans considered crime policy not tough enough, according to Gallup. Public reaction to the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody in May simply accelerated the pre-existing trend. And why is the public less punitive? This brings us to the second lesson of recent history. Punitive sentiment tends to move in tandem with the actual level of crime. Public support for harsh measures rose with violent crime rates in the 1970s and 1980s, then came down as the violent crime rate declined over the past quarter century. Ramirez identifies political leadership as a key variable. Punitive sentiment grew in the 70s and 80s as part of a broader racial backlash, including demonization of alleged black offenders that white conservative politicians deliberately stoked. Also, the public generally tends to believe the worst about crime, usually telling pollsters that it is growing even when official data shows the opposite. For all that, Clyburn's anecdote reminds us that public opinion also does have a basis in reality. The more people experience crime in their communities, in 1992, South Carolina's violent crime rate exceeded the national average, the more it becomes a political issue, ripe for demagogic exploitation, but also crying out for legitimate solutions. We may be experiencing a real-world test of these dynamics right now, in the sense that President Trump came to office railing against crime as if nothing had changed since the 1980s, when he took out newspaper ads decrying roving bands of wild criminals and calling for society to unshackle cops from the constant chant of police brutality. Yet punitive sentiment kept on moving down during Trump's presidency, along with the violent crime rate. Ramirez's 2013 article used opinion poll data collected between 1951 and 2006. In an email, he supplied an update showing trends through 2019. In backhanded acknowledgement of this, Trump leavens his calls for shooting rioters and jailing statue topplers with boasting about his signature on the First Step Act, which reformed federal sentencing and modestly reduced incarceration. An important point for reform is to deny Trump and other opponents any basis, either in rhetoric or in reality, for reigniting fear of crime. That is why Clyburn promptly distanced National Democrats from calls to slash spending on the police, telling Remnick, "I and a few others made it very clear we are not going to let defund the police become a headline that destroys this movement." It is also why the recent upsurge in shooting deaths in cities like Chicago, Atlanta, and St. Louis is such an important issue in human terms, but also politically. Trump is already trying to exploit it. The past 2+ decades of declining violent crime was one of the best things that ever happened for the cause of criminal justice reform. A reversal of that progress could be one of the worst. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, July 15, 2020. Joe Paez was born to Enrique and Jesusita Paez in Marfa, Texas, on August 16, 1936. He spent his childhood in Marfa and always had a place in his heart for the town, perhaps because it was where he met and married the most beautiful girl with the eyes that stood out and captivated him, Margarita Holguin. J. Joe was preceded in death by his parents, Jesusita and Enrique, his love and wife, Margarita, and his infant brother, Perfecto Paez. He leaves to cherish many precious memories his children, Joe Paez Jr., Anna Stark, Bill, Delia Carruth, Ronnie, Lucy Baez, Joe, Alicia Reed, Joe Henry Paez, Sheila, Corina Buendia, George. He also leaves behind a beautiful legacy of numerous grandchildren and great-children, great-grandchildren, all of whom were blessed to know him. Visitation will be Wednesday, July 15th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Ella's funeral home with a rosary at 7 p.m. Service will be Thursday, July 16th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe, with burial to follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Judith K. Tomlin. Judith K. Tomlin, 74, of Midland, Texas, entered into her final rest July 9, 2020. Judith was the daughter of J.B. and Catherine Pruitt, born October 18, 1945, in Lubbock, Texas. Judith is survived by her husband, David Tomlin, siblings David Pruitt and wife Sherry, Joanne Gray and husband Steve, children Ivana Shepherd and husband Tommy, John Worcester and wife Tammy, Brian Worcester and wife Brandy, Catherine Worcester and wife Dr. Kelly Wilkes, J.R. Tomlin and Amy Stevens, Wendy Tomlin, 12 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, J.B. and Catherine Pruitt, and son Brian Tomlin. A memorial service for Judith will be held at Kelview Heights Baptist Church in Midland on Thursday, July 16th at 10:30 a.m. The family asks attenders to please wear face masks. Mom was a very giving person, therefore the family asks in lieu of flowers to please make a memorial donation to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and or Hospice of Midland for their incredible work. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to Pipkin at nts-online.net. Or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Kathy Ann Coates. The family of Kathy Ann Coates would celebrate her life of 62 years at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, July 17th, First Christian Church in Lubbock, Texas. A time of fellowship and remembrance is scheduled from 5:30 to 8 p.m. Thursday, July 16th at Lake Ridge Chapel and Memorial Designers. She passed away peacefully on July 11, 2020, surrounded by family. In view of the health of her family, face coverings are mandatory while attending service and visitation. You are encouraged to sign the virtual guest book and share memories and expressions of sympathy by selecting the icon at www.memorialdesigners.net. Kathy was born July 29, 1957, in Lubbock, Texas, to Jean and Frankie Thomas. Survivors include her husband, Mark Coates of Granbury, son Joshua Coates of Weatherford, sisters Carol Gomez of Abilene, Connie Sanders of Tuscola, and Dawn Calden of Weatherford, several nieces and nephews, all of whom she loved and touched deeply. She is preceded in death by her daughter, Crystal Coates, brother Harley Thomas, mother Frankie Thomas, father Gene Thomas, stepfather Glenn Mayfield, and grandparents Asel and Cleo Corley. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts may be made to the donor's favorite charity or the Kelsey Logan Angel Fund, has agreed to take a final donation in Kathy's memory. 100% of donations go directly to the children and may be sent to P.O. Box 5072, Midland, Texas, 79704. Lucy Rose Lee. Lucy Rose Lee passed away on May 26th in Houston, Texas, after a lengthy battle with end-stage renal disease. She was born May 5, 1935, to Sarah and Fahed Hanna in Corpus Christi, Texas. In 1959, she married Will D. Dub Lee Jr. and spent the next 40-plus years traveling the oil community towns of Texas and raising their children. She is preceded in death by her husband, Dub, parents Sarah and Fahed Hanna, and her brothers Robert Hanna and Fahed Hanna Jr. Lucy is survived by her children, Robert Lee and wife Marie of Waller, Texas, and Jessica Lee Swiney and husband Raymond of Godley, Texas, and one brother, Dr. Donald Hanna, and wife Norma of Austin, Texas. She is also survived by 5 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren. Lucy's memorial service will be held at the Church of the Good Shepherd in Corpus Christi, Texas, when all of her family and friends can gather safely. A reception will follow the internment service. Ramiro Luna Jr. Ramiro Luna Jr., 68, of Midland, went home to his Heavenly Father on Sunday, July 12, 2020. Born on June 28, 1952, in San Angelo, Texas, Raymond was raised and educated in Midland, Texas. Raymond is survived by the love of his life, Eva Luna. He was met with a warm heavenly welcome from Jesus and his daughter and best friend, Barbara Pacheco. He leaves behind the great joys of his life, Bonnie and Johnny Baeza, Maddie, Elijah, and Ryan Luna. Ramiro also leaves to cherish his memory his parents, Ramiro and Nestora Luna, Richard Luna of Boulder, Colorado, Alex and Lisa Luna and their children, Norma and Terivo Duran and their children, Connie Luna and her children, Mary and Victor Perez and their children, Roxanne and Gilbert and their children. A private rosary and viewing will be held at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel on Friday, July 17th at 7 p.m. Only immediate family may attend the rosary and viewing. The rosary will be live-streamed at www.livestream.com/npw. We invite all who are comfortable to celebrate Raymond at a church service held at St. Anne's Catholic Church on Friday, July 24th at 10 a.m. Social distancing and mask will be required at both events. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Richard Drew Kiefer. Richard Drew Kiefer, age 60, died Monday, July 13th at 11 a.m. as the result of a tragic motorcycle accident. He was born in Amarillo, Texas on May 15, 1960, to Richard William Kiefer and Norma Jean Kiefer. He settled in Midland, Texas with his beloved wife Mary, who preceded him in death 2 years earlier. He is survived by his mother Norma, sister Shannon, 4 sons Chad, Daniel, Will, and Anthony, 9 grandchildren, and 1 great-grandchild. Services will be held at St. Anne's Catholic Church, 2000 West Texas Avenue, Midland, Texas, 79701, with a rosary on Thursday, July 16th at 7 p.m. and a funeral mass Friday, July 17th at 10 a.m. Flowers, cards, and donations to the family may be sent to St. Anne's or Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, 1502 North La Mesa Road, Midland, Texas, 79701.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, July 15th. Trustees vote to appoint member to position 4. The Ector County ISD Board of Trustees voted to appoint someone to fill the position 4 spot previously held by Doyle Woodall through an application process during their workshop meeting Tuesday. Woodall came under fire from social media posts that some people found offensive. Rather than wait until May 2021, when the regular election will be held, trustees decided to take applications. A survey was sent to Position 4 residents with 114 respondents. 95 people responded to an online survey, and 19 returned paper copies, Communications Officer Mike Atkins said. 78 said they wanted to appoint a resident of Position 4 rather than wait, while 36 said they wanted to wait for the May 2021 election. Stacy Walton, an ECISD teacher and resident of Position 4, said she was hoping that the board would have a special election. Those interested would fill out a form. They would have to be a resident of the district, be 18 years of age or older, and be a registered voter. A decision will likely be made at next Tuesday's meeting. In his opening remarks, Superintendent Scott Murray said there will be a large presentation on the opening of school that gets into specifics. Muni said a large task force with 18 subcommittees has been working on what that will look like, from how furniture is organized and what virtual learning will look like to how students are transported and how they will be fed. Because of the leadership of ECISD School Nutrition Director Brandon Reyes, Murray said every student in the district will receive breakfast and lunch free of charge. Murray said the start of school is planned for August 12th. The state has said that could be phased in over a three-week time period, but many superintendents and boards have pushed back, saying that wasn't enough time, so the state is now considering changing that. The three-week phase-in will still happen, but most students will be home on that first day learning virtually. As of the most recent results, from the early part of July, 65% of families requested some form of face-to-face instruction and 35% in a virtual environment. Murray said the district will provide virtual education for students in grades pre-kindergarten through 12. Parents will have to make a decision by July 29th on whether their children will attend school in person or at home. Murray said that decision must occur 2 weeks prior to the start of the school year. Parents could change their mind at the end of the first grading period. At this point, Murray said 97% of teachers are saying they want to work in a school building, which doesn't mirror what's happening in the state. Murray said word the district is hearing from the staff is that they are eager to return to work at a building based on how safe it is. He said ECISD did a good job in spring and summer keeping everyone safe. Cafeteria and ECISD police were frontline workers, and many were in contact with students and families on a regular basis. Operations kept facilities clean, Murray said. When the school year begins, numbers of bodies of students and employees will change. He added that feedback from staff is important, and officials will continue to get that. Murray said officials are working with human resources on a deadline for staff to decide to come back to campuses. If 35% of students want a virtual environment, the district will need a large number of teachers to provide support. Murray said a variety of perspectives will be taken into account. Quote, "It's a possibility that opening may be moved for us by the governor or TEA, the Texas Education Agency, or even the county judge can rule," Murray said. He added that a lot of districts that are in hot spots are moving the start date back. Murray said the school district could make those decisions on its own. Internally, he said there is a lead nurse and a doctor, and Murray meets with the Odessa College and UTPB presidents, county and city officials, and CEOs of both hospitals and the health department to get COVID-19 updates. The board approved an agreement with Elevate K-12 to provide virtual instruction for American Sign Language and German at Odessa and Permian high schools. The sections will cost $10,400 each, with a minimum of 8 sections. After an executive session, the board hired Executive Director of Leadership Corey Seymour. He is currently the Area Assistant Superintendent, Area Senior Director for Portland Public Schools in Oregon. School opening still up in the air. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. With cases of COVID-19 rising in Odessa, Plans to open Ector County ISD schools in the fall are changing with the times. In the last 2 weeks, Superintendent Scott Murray said things have started looking much worse than they were when initial plans were taking shape. Quote, "The likelihood of opening with kids and opening with as many kids as we want in our buildings seems to be fading," end quote, Murray said in a phone interview Monday. Quote, "Our community has heard me say, and I will continue to say, that we, to some degree, control our own destiny. The healthier we are as a community, the more likely it is that we can serve kids in our buildings, and we have to make sure that we're doing everything we can as a community, washing hands and wearing masks and social distancing. We've got to take care of ourselves and take care of the people around us," Murray said. "And one reason to do that is so that our kids can go back to school." Although President Trump and U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos have declared that schools need to open in the fall or they risk not receiving federal funding, Murray said ECISD has to do what's right for students. Quote, "If our kids and staff members are not safe, they cannot come back in our buildings. We have to do what's right for our community and the children that we serve and Odessa and Ector County," Murray said. "I think it's important to note, too, that the messaging we hear from the federal government is back to school, but what that really means is to educate kids, and that's exactly what we want to do. I don't disagree with any of that. We will begin educating kids on August 12th. End quote. Generally, school districts don't get a lot of their funding from the federal government. In Texas, it's mainly property taxes and state funding based on attendance. Murray said school in the fall may look very different from the way it's looked in the past because of the local health situation. Quote, "But we will educate kids. That is something that I can assure you we will do. Our staff members want to do that. Our teachers, our principals, our central office folks, our parents want our kids to be educated, so that's going to happen. It's the how that is the big question mark right now," Murray said. Murray had said the best teachers and administrators would go to the schools in the district that are most in need. Recently, a couple of the best teachers and principals switched roles and campuses. Quote, "When a principal is making his or her master schedule and you're determining who's going to teach which course, that is when those decisions are made. The principal is responsible for placing teachers in the specific courses that they teach, and as the principal is making those placements, you want to be strategic and thoughtful in who you assign to teach which particular courses. And so that is where those decisions are made at the school level, matching the very best teachers with the most fragile children. That's what we want to do in general in schools across the board. No matter what the school is, you want to take the talent of the teacher and match them with where their talent is going to be best utilized. That's the art of master scheduling," Murray said. Continuing the quote, "It is not an easy process for our principals. It is an art form to create a master schedule for an elementary, middle, or high school that effectively meets the needs of children because you're balancing the needs of kids with the talents of teachers," he added. From a promotion perspective, he said, "There are always opportunities in school districts for teachers to take on different roles, whether that's a teacher, coach, or administrator." Quote, "Many times, the individuals that get those roles have proven themselves to be effective in the classroom," Murray said. Former Odessa Collegiate Academy Advancement via Individual Determination Coordinator Elizabeth Gray and Elementary Math Coordinator Beatrice Mata have become teacher coaches. Quote, they will get to spread their work to many teachers and help many teachers go from good to great, if you will, Murray said. The state has announced that students will take the State of Texas Assessments of Academic Readiness, or STAR, this coming school year, but there has been pushback. Quote, a number of school districts in Texas have already announced that they will start the first 3 weeks of school completely virtual, and that is because they have such a large presence of COVID-19 in their communities that they simply can't safely bring back staff members or students, Murray said. Quote, that decision in itself affects the validity and reliability of a STAR assessment or an end-of-course exam. I think Texas is going to have a very difficult time validating the reliability of the STAR test this year simply because of COVID-19 and its impact upon the way that we're doing school. So I will not be surprised if TEA makes a different type of decision, he said. Right now, the decision is that all students in Texas will take the STAR. State Representative Brooks Landgraf, a Republican from Odessa, has sent a letter to the Texas Education Commissioner, Mike Morath, saying STAR should not be administered in the coming year. Quote, I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes an option rather than a requirement, Murray said. Attitudes have changed regarding parents who want online learning versus in-person as cases of COVID-19 continue to increase. Quote, as I talk to my colleagues across the state of Texas, the numbers are running, or they were 2 weeks ago, but they're now changing, but they were 70% of parents were wanting to face-to-face, and 30% were wanting virtual. In our district, that was 65-35. Now that's changing. When I talk to my colleagues in Houston, that number is now upside down. More parents are requesting virtual rather than face-to-face. We're starting to hear more of that in our own community, so there are a lot of similarities. Sometimes we think we're unique, but no, we're probably more similar than we are different, Murray said. The digital divide, where some students have internet access, while a lot of students do not, will not be solved by the time school starts in August. But Murray said ECISD will be further down the road. Quote, we've already made a decision to put a device in the hands of every child that needs one. We recognize that many of our kids don't have the tools, they don't have the computer or the laptop or whatever it is they need, so we'll be providing those for any of the children that do not have them, Murray said. But it's not getting the tools to the students that's the issue. It's the lack of broadband infrastructure. Quote, that is not going to be fixed in a month or two. That's a much longer process. But we're busy working on that. We commissioned a study. In fact, I was on a call a few minutes ago before I spoke with you on July 13th to get an update on that body of work. There are a lot of people weighing in on the kind of options that we have available as a community to make sure broadband exists in every family's home. It's been exciting to talk to people all over our community and our elected officials, county commissioners, city council members, lots of support for making sure that our kids and families have that level of access, so I'm excited to be able to work with our community to make this happen. But it is more than just a month away. It is a much longer build, if you will, Murray said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.